From 90.5 WESA, this is The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. For the first time in nearly 200 years, Pittsburgh will be a one daily newspaper town. The Pittsburgh Tribune Review will no longer be printed after November 30th. A free online service will be offered.
The paper is not the paper anymore. You cannot support a news gathering operation at the same level with digital-only revenues.
We'll look at the state of the media in Pittsburgh. With about 10 Pennsylvanians dying each day from drug overdoses, state lawmakers focus in on the growing opioid crisis.
We're trying to listen to everybody and come up with the best solution that we can.
We'll also discuss the battle between Congress and a Pittsburgh area company over the cost of EpiPens. That's all ahead on our weekly news roundup. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. Our weekly reporters roundup. I'm Kevin Gavin. State lawmakers act in a bipartisan way to try to ease the opioid crisis in Pennsylvania. House members are still upset with Mylan and the high cost of EpiPens, and the sports world in Pittsburgh lose a golf legend. But first, Pittsburgh also loses a daily newspaper. Trip Total Media announced Wednesday it will cease printing the Pittsburgh Tribune Review November 30th. 106 full-time and part-time employees face layoffs. President and CEO Jennifer Bertetto said they will move to a free digital version and will bolster their Greensburg Tribune Review and Valley News Dispatch papers. What will this mean to the Pittsburgh media landscape? Well, we're going to discuss that with Maggie Patterson, author and a professor of journalism at Duquesne University. Welcome, Maggie.
Thank you.
And also in studio is Andy Conti, director of the Center for Media Innovation at Point Park University and a former Tribune Review reporter. Welcome, Andy. Good to have you back.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Okay, let's start. Initial reactions. We'll start with Maggie.
Well, my reaction is that this is part of a shrinking of the Metropolitan Daily that's happening all over the country. And even though it will continue to print online, reporters are being let go. And that means that ultimately we're going to get less coverage. The watchdog will be quieter in the city with fewer reporters covering it.
Well, no doubt. I mean, nobody likes to see their friends getting laid off. And a lot of my friends, you know, I worked at the Trib for 15 years. A lot of my friends have lost their jobs, have moved on to other things, have taken the buyout. In fact, in terms of reporters, more of them took the buyout than got laid off. But there are fewer reporters. The good news to this, though, I think if there's any good news, is the fact that the Trib is dealing from a position of strength. You know, this isn't like in Detroit or Harrisburg and other cities where we've seen newspapers go to fewer days of, you know, ceasing their daily publications. They, you know, Detroit Free Press comes out 3 days a week. The Trib's doing this because they have some money left over. And the question was, well, how do you spend the rest of that money? What do you do with it? Do you just go ahead and keep spending it in a way that means, you know, you're losing it ultimately? Or do you try to spend it in a way that helps you figure out something better for the future? Or, you know, some financial model that allows the paper, in quotes, to exist.
So the investment, will it come, do you think, in the digital component, or will that investment come in two of its stronger publications that I mentioned before, the Valley News Dispatch and the Greensburg Tribune Review?
The Trib has dominant circulation in those areas. There's not any home delivery out there of other newspapers except the Trib. So the Trib owns those areas. In Pittsburgh, where there was the competition, they'll go online and they'll save the cost of printing and delivering in the city. And so that'll free them up to put their money into asking questions, having reporters, being on the street.
Well, I think that nationally, the papers that are doing well are the small community papers. And the Valley News Dispatch has a long, long history in that area of the tri-state region, and so does the Greensburg paper. It's the Metropolitan Daily that's hurting, and that's exactly where they're cutting back.
The parent company has been restructuring for quite a while, selling off some of the papers, offering the employee buyouts that you mentioned, Andy. So this action, could it even be considered a surprise, or was it just a matter of time before it actually happened?
We were really fortunate in Pittsburgh, right? For a long time, we've had two daily newspapers, completely independent, family-owned, by families who were willing to put any amount of money into them to keep them going. For Dick Scaife, who was the publisher of the Tribune Review, it came out of his personal funds. So whatever the Trib's shortfalls were, he was making them up. And he died in 2014. You know, and he left money to the paper. The question for the new management of the paper is, then what do you do with that money?
Well, I think that the question in the long term is, will the web edition be profitable enough to keep it going, or will it need continued support from the SCAFE family? I think
there's no money from the SCAFE family. So
there's no money left from the SCAFE family.
No, not that there's no money left. There's no money from the SCAFE family. So it's not even a question. So when Dick SCAFE died, there was money set aside for the paper, and he left the rest of his money to two foundations and sold off all of his assets. So there's no family ownership. We're not looking at the family being involved. It's actually governed by a board of trustees.
Rick Edmonds covers the newspaper industry's troubles at the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg, Florida. He spoke with WESA's Josh Rollerson.
I think the community's in pretty good hands. And, of course, in the current era, you get startups like Jim Brady's Incline and other new digital sites. So, you know, I don't know that it's tragic, but there is a sense of loss there.
Is it a sense of loss? And number two, what shape are we in terms of the media landscape?
We have allegedly one of the most complex media landscapes in the country in this area.
What do you mean allegedly?
Well, because I think that it's changing in that the websites that are starting up are specialized. A lot of them are entertaining, but we're not getting the hard-hitting reporting that we used to because the staffs at both papers are smaller, and that means fewer people to cover the beats, the city, the county, the courts that we need to know about as citizens, and it also means some diminishment of investment in investigative reporting, which is expensive.
Andy?
She's right in terms of the fact that the Trib had a great investigative team. Yeah. The whole I team is gone now. And so it's a question of how do you replace that? But once we get through this period of transition, I think, you know, something Maggie also alluded to was the idea that we're at the verge of something that could be pretty exciting. There are a lot of new groups coming online. The day that we opened the Center for Media Innovation at Point Park University, The Incline started. The Incline's right. A new online news outlet. The Tribune Review has its own spinoff called Upgroove. Maggie's a board member over at Public Source. Public Source is an investigative group that's all they do is ask the tough questions. When they first opened up, I thought, well, why are they coming in here? The Trib's already got an investigative team. The Post-Gazette's doing investigative stories. But the fact is now we're getting to the point where Public Source, they've got a good team of people and they're asking good questions. It's incumbent on all of us to continue asking good questions. WSA, I mean, you guys are out here asking good questions all the time. At one point, you know, you could kind of sit back and say, well, the newspaper is going to take care of it. But now it's on everybody to ask the questions and to be vigilant. And, you know, in some ways, it's an exciting time because there are lots of little publications that are growing up. And anybody with internet access can be a publisher.
You seem excited. What do you tell the people who say, I just like to hold a newspaper in my hands, because a lot of us still like to hold a book, still like to hold that newspaper.
There was a lot of shock from people saying, oh, I can't believe that Pittsburgh could be a city without a daily newspaper. Because, you know, like on holidays now, the Post-Gazette doesn't print a newspaper either. And you say, okay, would you take the newspaper? And people are like, oh, no, I read it for free online. Okay, but people like the idea of the newspaper. The other thing is people want information immediately now. Then they want lots of information. So that's the good news about it. Even people who are kind of nostalgic about the newspaper would say it's tough to compete with the newspaper when you're seeing the news on TV, you're hearing it on the radio, seeing it online immediately. By the time you get the newspaper, no matter how quickly we get the newspaper out, it's already dated information.
We're talking with Andy Conti, the director of the Center for Media Innovation at Point Park University, and Maggie Patterson, professor of journalism at Duquesne University. And we're discussing the ceasing of printing of the daily newspaper, the Tribune Review in Pittsburgh. The Greensburg Tribune Review moved into the Pittsburgh market in May of 92 during the 8-month strike that halted printing of both the Afternoon Pittsburgh Press and the Morning Post Gazette. In January of 93, the strike ended as the Block family, the owners of the Post-Gazette, acquired the press from Scripps and then folded the press into the Post-Gazette.
We are middle-of-the-road people. St. Louis is a morning and Sunday. Dallas now a morning and Sunday. And you look around, the cities of the general size of Pittsburgh are in even larger. You have that same situation.
That was William Block, chairman of the Post-Gazette, at a news conference I attended January 15, 1993. He said at the time it was inevitable that Pittsburgh would become a one-paper town. Apparently, he thought the Trib would retreat to Greensburg once the PG resumed publishing. Was that ever a possibility? Once Mr. Scaife had his newspaper in Pittsburgh, that he would actually pull back to Greensburg and say, okay, back to you, Post-Gazette.
Well, I think that probably had to do with Scaife's personality as much as anything and his feeling about a liberal paper winning the day in the city, and he wanted a conservative alternative.
From my perspective, having worked for Dick Scaife for 15 years, he was very much committed to Pittsburgh having two voices, to Pittsburgh having good investigative reporting. We had the resources there to do national stories, you know, to do national investigations. There definitely was a commitment to do good reporting here. And I think what you're going to see with the Trib is that that commitment's going to continue. The people that they have, that they've put in charge there, that are going to be left behind are really smart, forward-thinking. They're excited about the digital product. They're excited about what they're putting together. So I think it's going to be pretty exciting to watch.
Over the last 9 years, I believe at least 14 daily newspapers have shut down, including the Rocky Mountain News, Natty Post, Tampa Tribune, Albuquerque Tribune. Some have switched to a digital format only. I believe, as far as the records I can find, show that if you don't count that eight-month strike, the Post-Gazette and the press in 92 into early 93, Pittsburgh has remained at least a two-newspaper town, and sometimes for many years more than two, since at least the mid-1800s, longer than many other markets. You mentioned before, Maggie, that we were lucky to have two newspapers.
Oh, very lucky to have it.
But, so
yeah.
Why did we?
Well, I suppose it's because there was an advertising base here that was willing to support it. That's one of the things that's being lost and not really replaced in the digital world yet. It's starting to, but it's not clear that there's a solid economic base there. But I also wanted to go back to something that Andy said earlier about it being an exciting time. And I don't mean to be the gloom sayer here, but there's also something that's being lost when we shift to digital, that the traditional way of presenting news allowed people to see more of what was going on generally. So let's say I'm reading the paper and I'm not really interested in what's going on in Afghanistan, but I'm going to see that. I'm going to see that something's in the headline, that something's going on. The same with traditional ways of broadcast news. The whole broadcast would have a variety of national, international, local stories. People are increasingly selecting the news that they get. And we are, and the outlets are setting up digital algorithms in order to feed them what they've already indicated that they're interested in. So there's this phenomenon which has this wonderful name of homophily, which means birds of a feather fly together, that the internet, which has opened the doors internationally to the exchange of information, is in many ways dividing us into narrow channels, that we're getting what we're interested in. And I think the students that I've seen in the last 5 years are the best educated, brightest group I've ever seen, but the least informed, that they don't consume any but a very narrow channel, often of celebrity news.
So we're fighting an uphill battle because aren't more visitors to digital online information landing on a story page rather than the homepage of whatever that media entity is, Andy?
Right. There's a lot going on with social media that way. If you get your news through Facebook or Twitter, that you're only seeing the stories that come into your feed. And that's where we see things going viral that way. But I will say, at Point Park, with the students that I deal with, I've seen a change with them just over the last year that didn't exist before. They no longer talk about wanting to go to work for somebody else. Mm-hmm. They want to be content creators themselves, and they want to figure out ways to make money off of that. There's a lot of respect for the YouTubers out there who are creating content and getting paid for it. The same with people who are creating their own websites and saying, you know, I'm going to cover this one niche and I'm going to make money off of it. And so I think that's where we're going to be hopeful.
Some analysts have said that having two competing newspapers makes for better, more enterprising coverage. We talked a little bit about that, but I want to talk about, has the nature of competition in the media changed? And is that a good thing? Is that more challenging for the different media in terms of, it used to be newspaper versus newspaper. If you did radio news, it was against the other radio news producers, if you would, TV stations versus TV. But it's all those lines have blurred, and of course with online, because many of those outlets have multi-platforms to present their product.
Yeah, it's definitely an evolving situation. It used to be, you know, with the newspapers, competition was real, and readers, even though they probably didn't realize it, benefited quite a lot. But what you're seeing now instead is that you've got lots of outlets that are competing for that information and competing for that space. And so public source is the same thing. They want to have the story first out there. Or the Post-Gazette, you know, they're doing this great series this year on opioids, and they're really moving the needle on that. Or the Trib, you know, has done all kinds of investigative stories. And so among all those organizations, you want to be the one that's doing stories that are people care about, that are getting attention, and then are moving the needle in terms of, you know, getting some sort of government response.
So the ceasing of the printing of the daily newspaper, the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, does that leave a hole or does that leave an opportunity?
Well, I think it leaves a hole in the sense that it's accompanied by laying off reporters. There are definitely wonderful opportunities in this changing world. In addition to the competition, there's also an increasing collaboration among media. And that's kind of making the heads of journalists spin because we're so used to competing. I remember working at the press when the Post-Gazette was those were the people we had to beat. And that does drive you. But now the world is so much in flux that organizations like Public Source are sharing what they're doing. And they have media partners that reprint, rebroadcast, do their stories in a different form. So I think it's very hard to say, here's the picture of what the media is today, because it's a moving target.
Maggie's absolutely right. It's fascinating that the reporters from different organizations are like hanging out. Part of it is being driven by the fact that if you're not sharing information, they're just taking it anyway, right? I mean, the Incline calls itself a curator of news, you know, so they come in and they're coming into this marketplace and saying, all right, these are the stories of the day you need to know about. Or Adam Schuck, who does the daily email blog, Eat That, Read This, he goes through and he basically runs a list of headlines for, you know, stories that Pittsburghers need to know about. But there's always something on his list that, as well-read as I am, there's always something that new that I learned by reading it. And I think it is definitely a weird phenomenon having gone through the competitive times. I mean, reporters always got along, and I always got along with the individual reporters, but the management of the companies never got along. And you're seeing that shifting now where there's mutual respect among all these groups, and the challenge is who can go out and do the best story of the day. And it actually could be kind of exciting going forward.
Or can we do a better story together than we could do separately? There's some discussion of that that I don't think we ever would have imagined happening even 10 years ago.
Maggie Patterson is an author and professor of journalism at Duquesne University. Andy Conti is director of the Center for Media Innovation at Point Park University and a former Tribune Review reporter. Thanks to both of you.
Oh, thank you, Kevin.
The House Oversight Committee members want more information from Mylan about the high cost of and profits from the life-saving EpiPen. That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESN. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Last week, Heather Bresch, CEO of Mylan, which operates out of Cecil Township, was grilled by the House Oversight Committee over the company's raising its price for EpiPens by 500% since 2007. The epinephrine auto-injectors used to counteract severe allergic reactions now go for $608 for a pack of two. This week, House members demanded more information from Bresch about its profits from the product. Joining me in studio to discuss the latest in the controversy involving this Pittsburgh-area drug manufacturer are Wes Ventischer, reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Welcome, Wes.
Thanks for having me.
And Len Baselovic, business reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome, Len.
Hey, Kevin.
Also joining us is Mark Knupp, our WESA reporter. Good to have you here, Mark.
Thank you very much.
If you have a question or comment for our guests, you can tweet us at WESA Confluence. So let's start a little bit of a primer, a little background, if you would, about Mylan. What's the company do? How big? Pittsburgh area operations in Cecil Township. Len, you want to start?
Yeah, they have pretty significant operations out in Cecil. They have a big manufacturing plant down in Morgantown.
Okay. So they're the second largest in the world generic and specialty drug maker. That's my understanding. So we're talking a lot of employees, and we're talking a lot of products. I believe 1,400 products?
Something like that, yeah. And their revenue last year was about $9.5 billion.
Okay. and I believe $1 billion in revenue, not net, but $1 billion approximately came from the EpiPen. And that's what we're going to focus on in our discussion right now. The price that Mylan charges didn't just jump from $100 for a two-pack to $608 in one step, did it? So why, gentlemen, why did this anger sort of erupt or come to a head in August? Wes?
Well, in August, people were starting to take their kids back to school, and parents started noticing these prices. They've been slowly going up. I believe in 2014, they were around $400. And so it happened to come to a head now. There's also been news lately. You saw with Turing Pharmaceuticals CEO Martin Shkreli raising the price of an AIDS drug by about 5,000%. So I think it's been in the public's attention a little bit more recently.
Yeah, there's actually an analyst in June who put out a report that Mylan discredited, but the analyst's take was, are they next to face the outrage over price hikes? And he said that within the last year, there were something like 24 Mylan products that had increased more than 20%.
Okay. Now, it seems to me that any smart company would find a market, cultivate a market, maybe even create a market for its products. Is that what Mylan did in part with schools? Wes mentioned that as people, the students were going back to the schools, parents sort of noticed this. But is that Mark Newtbar, is that what Mylan did in part with schools? Because Pennsylvania is one of, I believe, 48 states that have some sort of law either requiring or allowing epinephrine auto injectors.
It sure does seem that their lobbying arm was trying to build a strong base here. Several years ago, the federal government passed legislation that said if your state has a bill that would require or allow epinephrine to be in schools, we're going to make sure that you get preferential treatment when it comes to getting grants for asthma-related projects. All of a sudden, we start to see states pass these types of legislation. In Pennsylvania, there were two pieces of legislation that were introduced, one in the Senate that would have required that all schools have this, and then one in the House that would just simply say you are allowed to have it. The one for requiring it did come out of the Education Committee, but never got a full vote on the Senate floor. The one in the House was passed, so that is part of the law here. And one of the lawmakers actually admitted with that Senate bill that he had help writing that bill from the two companies that make these auto injectors.
Yeah, actually, at the hearing, it came up, and there was a separate story. There have been several stories about Heather Brush's mom being involved in some of these and promoting some of these ideas.
Because I believe she was on the board.
She was on the board of education in West Virginia, yeah.
Right. So, but Heather Brush also said, well, we've given away 500,000 of these. 700,000. I'm sorry. Okay. So hundreds of thousands. So that looks like a good idea, but they do also have to be replaced, Wes, as they're being used, or the shelf life, I believe, is approximately a year or so for the product.
Yeah, they say maximum 18 months. That's one of the things that has people upset. As people are having to replace these things every year, too, things are changing in the health insurance world. People are being required to pay a greater share of medicines like this through plans that have higher deductibles and whatnot. That's contributing for sure.
And also, if you have a kid who goes to daycare, who goes to sports, who goes to a babysitter, who goes to grandma's, do you carry one of these everywhere or do you need one at that particular place? So in many cases, it's not just about buying one $800 two-pack.
Right. You need multiples, and plus the bigger the school, you might need multiples. Who knows how many you're going to need immediately. You know, you might need a couple of packs in one day if you have a large enough school population, if there's an allergic reaction. So, Mark, it seems logical that schools would want to have this. I mean, they want to protect kids, and whether it's for the children, the students, who already know they have an allergy, or to help the children of parents who don't necessarily know they have the allergic reaction until they actually have it.
Yeah, a study that came out of Massachusetts showed that a quarter of all kids who receive an EpiPen or an epinephrine injection had no prior allergy history.
So what was that, a quarter?
A quarter of the kids that had some sort of anaphylactic reaction to something. Could have been food, could have been any other airborne thing or a bee. So I think what we're really talking about here, is this a public health issue, or is this a marketing issue, or is it somewhere right in between where it's good public health and a great business opportunity at the same time?
Yeah, and the problem that's compounding it is there are very few alternatives. Sanofi pulled their product off the market last year because there were problems whether people were going to be getting the right dosage. And Teva, a big Israeli generic maker, has not been able to get approval from the FDA. So Mylan has, I think, something like 93% of the market.
Is that mathematically considered to be a monopoly, or does it have to be 100%?
I don't know if there's a strict definition in this case or not, but I think people can draw their own conclusions.
But you know, what is curious to me is that this technology, just as an EpiPen, has been around for more than a decade. And we have had auto-injector type devices for even longer than that. Now, maybe it's because epinephrine needs to be more controlled as to how much you get in your body as compared to, I think about all of those war movies that you see where they're hitting themselves with morphine or whatever it is that's in there. Maybe that's a little bit different. But it seems like somebody should be able to figure out how to make these things and sell them.
Yeah.
So yeah. There's all kind of upset at this House Oversight Committee hearing September 21st. Let's listen to an exchange between Chairman Jason Chaffetz and company CEO Heather Bresch, who tried to reduce a bit of the heat on her and her company by saying that Mylan is introducing its own generic version of the EpiPen, which the company will market, she said, directly to consumers.
By introducing a generic, which truly is unprecedented, I mean, we cut the price in half. So
well,
I know
it's unprecedented to raise the price $500 or 500%. So you're raising it to lower it, but your net revenue goes up. How can you claim it goes down?
What we receive is the $200, and we're estimating.
You said you're selling it direct for $300.
That we said that the wholesale acquisition price would be $300.
Okay, you've got to help clarify for this for us, because this does not make sense.
Wes Lynn, did we learn anything from that Oversight Committee hearing? Wes?
Well, we learned that they were, of course, hesitant to... Well, one thing that we learned specifically after the Oversight hearing has been interesting, where they said that they were making the certain amount, $100 per two-pack. After the hearing was over, they filed something with the SEC this Monday saying that in that profit figure, they had included a 37.5% tax rate, which is the statutory tax rate, not what most corporations end up paying at the end of the day after deductions and whatnot. So that was considered disingenuous by this committee, and I think for them fit a pattern of what they felt they had been seeing.
Yeah, and the problem with that 37.5% rate is that not only has Mylan faced the ire over the EpiPen, but they and the rest of the drug industry have faced the ire over these corporate inversions where they relocate overseas to lower their tax bill. So what...
In this case, the Netherlands.
Yeah.
And that was within the last
year
or so?
That was last year.
Okay.
Last year. So, I mean, her father, Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia, took some heat over that, and now he's sort of facing the same kind of heat over the EpiPen.
So... You mentioned the Securities and Exchange Commission and documents, and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services have said Mylan misclassified the device, shortchanging the government on rebates. Who's getting, if somebody's getting shortchanged, who is it? The feds, the state governments, and how so?
Those rebates are paid to the either the state who runs the Medicare Medicaid program or to the federal government. And I think Minnesota put a number on it of like $4.3 million. I don't know what period that was. But there's a substantial amount of money involved, the rebate that Mylan would pay based on the way they're doing it, which they say is correct, versus what CMS does.
Anybody else?
Yeah, just kind of to take that a little bit one step further, Wes was mentioning how some insurance companies, when we're talking about privately buying this, some insurance companies are making people pay more. And, you know, so I think that's showing up on the radar, but it's still, as a private user, I'm probably not paying the full boat. When you look at school districts, they might be paying that full boat. But when you look at the size of the budget that any school district has, are they really looking at a $600 purchase that's made in the nurse's office? You know, it, like I said, it's somewhere between marketing and public health. And if you can push this through at an ever-increasing price, maybe it just makes good business sense.
Well, I think, and the one thing that's compounding is that just who was getting what in all of this is not clear to a lot of people. And that was clear at the hearing last year, last week. She had all kind of charts, information that we're getting something like 274 of the 600, but I think members of the committee were very skeptical about that.
All right, we have a gentleman. We have about 2 minutes left. I want to quickly get to a couple of things. Some senators, I believe, 3 senators wrote to the Justice Department about a possible investigation. Have we heard anything about whether the Justice Department will investigate? And if they do, what might they investigate?
So far, we haven't heard what the response is from the Justice Department to that request. There's been some other talk about the Secretary of Health, Burwell, yesterday was, you know, again reiterating that we need to, or according to her, have Medicare be able to negotiate drug prices with companies, which doesn't happen now, is not allowed under the Medicare's Part D program, which deals with prescription drugs. Both presidential candidates have said that that's something that they support, Hillary Clinton more vociferously than Donald Trump. But so far, I haven't heard a policy solution or, a specific policy solution. We haven't heard whether the Justice Department will do anything about this or what they would do.
In our final minute, the ranking Democrat, Elijah Cummings, on that House Oversight Committee said they don't believe the numbers that have been provided so far by Mylan and gave the company 10 days from the date of the hearing to provide internal year-by-year files. And so what is it that they're really seeking? And if they don't get it, what are they going to do?
Yeah, I don't know if they'll do anything based on what's happened with a lot of this outrage before. A couple of analysts said back in August when this all popped up, oh, the school year gets started, get into the school year, this is going to blow over. But I think, you know, with these several investigations going on, this has more legs than a lot of people thought it might have.
And I don't think the demand is going to go away on this at all. There are, I just looked up some numbers, 99,000 schools in the U.S., 3,000 schools here in Pennsylvania. And when Matt Smith was introducing the legislation back in 2013, he said, maybe I'll introduce some legislation that would expand this to restaurants, libraries, community centers, and have training like that. So it could get even bigger.
Yeah, it's hard to know what could come of this, since there, at least so far, aside from the Medicaid possibility, it's just in terms of how they market this drug to people with private insurance, there are no real rules against this. And so they can continue to try to make Mylan look bad, but that can only go so far since, as we said, Mylan right now is the only viable maker of this product.
Wes Ventischer is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, Len Baselovic, business reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and WESA reporter Mark Newbar. Thanks to all of you for joining us.
Sure.
Thank you.
With 10 Pennsylvanians dying every day from drug overdoses, can state lawmakers do anything that will help in the short term? We'll discuss the legislative focus on the opioid crisis next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. 422 Allegheny County residents died from drug overdoses last year. That's about 1 in every 8 of the such fatalities in Pennsylvania. Across the state, fatal overdoses jumped some 23% in 2015. Wednesday, Governor Wolf addressed a joint session of the General Assembly urging lawmakers to take action to address the opioid crisis. Joining us by phone from Harrisburg is Mark Levy from the Associated Press. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
Also in Harrisburg is Ben Allen, health reporter for WITF. Excuse me. Welcome, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or comment, you can tweet us at WESA Confluence. So, gentlemen, what was the essence of Governor Wolf's message to the House and Senate? How was it received? Let's start with you, Mark.
Well, it was received very well, but it was a message of, you know, it's time to take a stand against addiction. It's a crippling disease. And it was a message of, let's do this together. There's been a bipartisan spirit in this building this year. This is what Wolf told lawmakers, and we should fight this together. And he got a standing ovation from both sides of the aisle.
Ben, what was your take?
I think that the message was largely what Mark just said. I think the one note here is that what the governor has said, he's largely been saying for, you know, probably a year at this point. It wasn't necessarily anything new in terms of his message about the opioid crisis and the heroin crisis and how to fix it. There have been some new proposals, but I think the new thing here is that he's trying to rally legislative support in such a unique way, something that hasn't been done. I don't think a joint session has really occurred in the House and Senate in a long time at the Capitol. So that may highlight it a little bit more. But in terms of the message of this being a crisis and this is an epidemic and we need to take action, I mean, that's a message he's had for at least a year now.
So when you guys talk to individual lawmakers, do you feel that there's a sense of urgency on their part to deal with this problem?
There is a sense of urgency on it. It's a subject that's wrapped up rural lawmakers, urban lawmakers. Their constituents are all feeling it in one way or another, whether it's opioids, whether it's heroin. So there is an urgency to get it done. Some of these bills were, you know, a couple of years in the making with various lawmakers, various legislative agencies holding hearings throughout the state over the past couple of years. And some of these bills were really only introduced in the last couple months, perhaps June even. So they haven't been sitting around gathering dust for a couple of years or for even more than, you know, several months at this point. And, you know, the governor's office was focused on in the spring coming to the realization that something needed to get done and the legislative session is ending on November 30th. And they took a look at, you know, what are the concepts that we can get through the legislature this year? What are the bills that are out there? What's sort of the consensus that we can get? And they worked to do that over the summer. To bring the chambers together and try to kind of sharpen the focus on a handful of concepts.
I heard a rather, I'd consider sobering, comment from Republican Senator Gene Yaw of Bradford County. He said the legislature's influence on the epidemic is limited.
I will feel very fortunate if we can make a difference in this problem in 10 years. So it is not going to be an overnight solution by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, I don't know that anyone expects any piece of legislation to be an overnight solution, but making a difference in 10 years. Mark, can't some of the bills, aren't they designed to have some much more immediate impact?
You know, Jake Corman, the majority leader, phrased it this way. He said, you know, we can't wave a magic wand and make this go away. We're trying to give people tools to use to fight this epidemic. There's been a growing realization among the various communities, say, for instance, the doctors in the past couple of years and an education effort to sort of understand the implications of prescribing methods and prescribing practices. And they, you know, for instance, the Medical Society believes that, you know, this education effort over the past couple of years is beginning to have an effect and beginning to yield dividends here. And so whatever the legislature does now may not necessarily have an immediate effect, but it may yield dividends over time. One immediate effect of these bills may be that it shuts off kind of an unlimited supply of opioids from emergency rooms. That's perhaps the most dramatic step. Another dramatic step would be requiring doctors to check a prescription drug database every time they prescribe opioids. So those two steps may have some sort of effect. It may not be visible right away, but over time, I know there's the hope that it will have a substantial effect.
Ben,
I want to jump in here. Jump in here, because one of the comparisons that I've heard is that, you know, if you think of this epidemic as a balloon, you know, each piece of the puzzle, if you will, to solve the epidemic is and get rid of it is squeezing the balloon a little bit. And if you only squeeze in one part, the problem just spreads to another part. The balloon inflates, you know, on the other side. So it really is a systemic problem, and that demands systemic solutions. And so just squeezing a little bit, you know, if you just squeeze on the prescriptions in doctor's offices, well, how are you going to make sure that those people don't end up going to the street immediately and turning to heroin where they were doing, Vicodin or other kind of prescription opioids that people are familiar with? I think that's really one of the main concerns when I talk with policymakers, not just legislators, but policymakers who actually have to implement this stuff and are in the weeds on this. You know, if you do one thing, the fear is that people drift to another thing because this addiction is so strong. So that's certainly something to consider. I know that there was some concerns when this prescription drug monitoring program went into place, and it's happened in other states. There's been concerns that as if you don't intervene with someone that you just denied opioids to, and you don't get them the help that they may need, that they may, again, just go to the street and get something to feed their addiction because it is that strong.
All right, gentlemen, we have just 1 minute left. And so what do you think is the most likely piece of legislation to get passed, whether it's the limiting the prescriptions issued in emergency rooms, maybe so they don't get hooked on the painkillers to begin with, or requiring the physicians to check the database more often, or something else? We'll start with you, Mark.
Well, the low-hanging fruit here will be the education pieces. So requiring curriculum in medical schools or at least not requiring it, but offering it, public school education about opioid addiction, continuing education for doctors on prescribing practices, things like that are the low-hanging fruit. The more challenging bills to pass will be the 7-day prescriptions from emergency rooms and the every prescription checking of the database. The governor himself said he doesn't know whether those can pass, but my sense is that it can get done.
Ben, he left you with 10 seconds.
Yeah, I'll agree with Mark on the low-hanging fruit, and I think that, you know, if there is some action, I would look more for the emergency room action on the 7 days limiting that, because I think that there is a little bit of a groundswell on that.
Mark Levy is a reporter with the Associated Press. Also in Harrisburg, Ben Allen, health reporter at WITF. Gentlemen, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Palmer from behind has sighted this putt. It's an important putt. Everybody understands. There is silence. Hearts stop beating. It's rolling and into the hole.
A look ahead. A public commemoration, celebration of the life of golf icon Arnold Palmer will be held Tuesday at 11 a.m. at St. Vincent College in Latrobe. The sports legend died Sunday at age 87. Joining us now to share some of his memories is Marino Paracenso, past president of the Golf Writers Association of America and the 2008 winner of the PGA Lifetime Achievement Award in Journalism. He wrote for the Post-Gazette for 35 years before his retirement. Marino, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Marino, when did you first start covering golf? And do you remember the first event that you covered that included Arnold Palmer?
I first covered anything with Palmer was something called a PGA two ball they played at Laurel Valley. As I recall, it was 71 or 72. They had it a couple of times. And I didn't know Arnold. I knew who he was, of course, but that was it. We did not become acquaintances or friends or anything at that time.
The Post-Gazette published an entire section on the life of Arnold Palmer. Marino, you did a story for that special section. Under your byline, you wrote, "Forgive the first person jottings. Writing about Arnie is nothing but personal." Why did it become that way? And can you imagine any other athlete you covered that it would be that way, personal?
No, not really. Jack Nicklaus became close. And this is no reflection on any other athlete. It's just that that was that magnetism with Palmer. It was always just you and him. Even if it was a crowd and you asked him a question, it was still you and him. That was an amazing thing with that man. And that's why I moved into the first person. You never do that when you're a writer, or rarely do you do that when you're a reporter, a writer.
So I have to ask you then, you said never do you do that. So is there a boundary that you have to be wary of crossing journalistically?
Yes. Yes, there is. And it's one of the dangers of the journalist, but I found it was never a problem with Palmer. You never become a friend. Well, you can't, as you know. You become good acquaintances with a lot of athletes that you cover over the years, and you become acquaintances. You become rather friendly, but you're not kissing cousins, because very often you have to be objective in your writing. So you write the good and you write the bad. And when you write the bad, they don't like it. But Palmer, it never bothered him. You don't want to hurt somebody's feelings, but you just have to do what you have to do. Either that or you better find another line of work. But you never had to worry that Palmer was going to be angry with you. You know, the other guys, you'd say, well, I hope they're not angry. But if they are, that's the way it goes. Tough luck.
Is it fair to say Palmer was comfortable with just about everybody, whether it's presidents to the average person?
I have never seen him uncomfortable with anybody. And one day, Eisenhower showed up at his door as a surprise gift for his birthday, saying, you got a place for an old man to sleep. And this is Dwight Eisenhower. I recall going down to do an interview, and I said to Doc, is it all right if he comes in and listens to the interview? Sure. He walks in. I said, Arnold, this is my nephew, Tom. He shakes his hand, and this is a grown man, and he shakes his hand. Hey, Tom, how you doing? And when we left, Tom said, it's like I knew him all my life. And I said, yeah, that's the feeling you get. It's weird, but it's very pleasant.
We're used to hearing about an athlete who refuses to talk with the media, or maybe they're just plain boring interviews. Didn't seem that way with Arnie. In fact, you've written that Arnold Palmer gave you the greatest interview of your career.
Oh, I can't imagine anything that would top that.
This was the 76 Masters. Can you set the scenario for us?
Sure. Remember, I didn't know Palmer at the time, so it's not that he was being friendly with me. I was just another golf writer. In terms of golf, it was a disaster. He shot 81 in the Masters, and anybody can do it, but Palmer does it. That's a story, and I got to go talk to him. And I really don't want to, because it's going to be unpleasant. He was sitting in his locker, hunched over, his elbows on his knees. He was looking at a can of beer, staring at the floor, and dejected. His hair was messed. And we stood there awkwardly, the bunch of us right in front of him. And finally, one of our guys broke the silence and said, Arnold, sorry we have to talk to you at a time like this. Palmer looked up and said, fellas, we talked when times were good. We'll talk when times are bad. And that is just a stunning thing for an athlete, a sports figure, to say. As I said, I don't remember why he said he shot 81. The story was those first 13 words.
Marino Paracenso is a nationally acclaimed golf journalist, winner of the PGA Lifetime Achievement Award for journalism. Marino, thanks so much for sharing your memories.
Thank you.
And finally, what's not ahead? Musicians of the Pittsburgh Symphony put down their instruments and picked up picket signs, going on strike today. The symphony has canceled its Pops concert series scheduled for this weekend. And for this week, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together. Engineer Tom Hurley, production assistance from Vince Balestrino. Our producer is Marcus Charleston. Thanks to our guests, And thanks to you for listening. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.